This is KUT Austin.
Stop. This is KUT. I'm Jennifer Staten. A perfect storm of circumstances has helped create what a University of Texas at Austin professor calls the new innovation economy. What's that? Craig Watkins says it's a completely different mindset about life and work, formed when technology, education, creativity, and civic inclination meet a tough post-recession job market for millennials. Craig Watkins is the founding director of UT's Institute for Media Innovation and the author of Don't Knock the Hustle, Young Creatives, Tech Ingenuity, and the Making of a New Innovation Economy. Watkins and his team interviewed more than 100 young people in the U.S. and Europe. What emerged from those discussions was a description of a system that incorporates time and space for the side hustle.
You know, I've spent most of my research career kind of studying young people's relationship to technology, so it's just been a sort of continual evolution. But, you know, we're hearing more and more about the so-called gig economy and the challenges that young people face in that economy. You know, there's been an ongoing debate about their relationship to technology and whether or not it makes them antisocial and addicted to the technology. And I just felt like it was really time to sort of get young people's perspective, millennials' perspective. And so this is really kind of a deep dive into their world to sort of see what they think about these issues.
So the title of the book is Don't Knock the Hustle, Young Creatives, Tech Ingenuity, and the Making of a New Innovation Economy. What is the new innovation economy? What do you mean when you talk about that? You know, you talked about the gig economy, but what do you mean by that phrase?
Yeah, so typically when we think of the innovation economy, we almost instinctively think of Silicon Valley and the companies that have sprang up from there, and then even sort of the innovation hubs that we have, for example, like here in Austin. But I was really curious about something that's happening kind of on the edges of that more formal economy. And it's what I call the new innovation economy, one that is being driven largely by young people, by millennials. And it's an economy, right, that really sort of thinks about innovation and technology in very different ways. So unlike Silicon Valley, for example, the new innovation economy makes as a starting principle the idea of diversity and inclusion. So it's much more likely to have women involved, young people of color involved. That's very distinct from Silicon Valley. The new innovation economy is likely to be invested in creating startups that are designed for social impact. So a lot of civic-related enterprises, this mantra of doing well by doing good is sort of a driving principle. And then also kind of the geography of the new innovation economy, where it takes place, right? So not in some innovation lab in Google or some classroom or lab on the University of Texas's campus, but really in coffee shops and apartments, in community labs and spaces. And so it's really just a new way of thinking about innovation and how it happens outside of the sort of traditional spaces.
Give us an example of this new innovation economy in practice. What does it look like?
Yeah, so as you can imagine, Austin was a really sort of prominent case study, or offered a series of case studies for looking at this. And we, my research team, we looked at other places as well. But one example might be a group of local independent game developers here in Austin who came to call themselves Juegos Rancheros. And this is a group of young people. Many of them moved to Austin to work in the game industry, to work in the interactive industry. As we know, working in the industry can be kind of hit or miss. It's very cyclical in terms of the game industry. And so for a lot of those people who've been laid off, right, in the recent sort of wave of layoffs and kind of the redefinition of the industry's footprint here in town, they sort of created their own alternative ecosystem, their own alternative sort of community for developing games. And so basically what they would do is meet monthly to share ideas about games that they were working on, really to create a space to have conversation with each other about ideas, new software that allows you to make games fairly cheaply. But it was a way of really sort of building an entirely new and innovative kind of creative subculture that young people making games were sort of gravitated towards in order to sort of continue pursuing their interest in designing games, even when those opportunities in the more formal economy seem to be sort of disappearing for more and more of them.
What are the circumstances that sort of gave rise to this new innovation economy?
Yeah, so part of it, right, is they're sort of creative young people's creative reaction to or response to the so-called gig economy. I think part of, because, you know, young people, and in this book, I sort of, you know, talk about young creatives, but these are really millennials, right? And they just live in an interesting moment. So they're the most educated generation in U.S. history. And yet, you know, their economic circumstances oftentimes fall below generations of earlier young people. They're also the largest segment of the U.S. working force now. They make up about a fourth of the population. And yet, you know, access to meaningful, upwardly mobile jobs are becoming increasingly difficult to find. And so a lot of what I write about in the book, and part of the title, right, Don't Knock the Hustle, is this notion of, we heard over and over and over again about the side hustle. So this idea, right, that you have a job during the day that pays the rent, you know, pays the bills, but then you have this other thing, right, this side thing that you pursue at night or on weekends or whenever you can find time, the so-called side hustle. And that's really, right, where the passion projects, the creative energies, were really expressed in ways that the more formal economy simply did not allow them.
And is all of that because of 2008 and the crash then? Is that how we got such that the economic landscape looked that way?
Yeah, absolutely. It's still in some ways, right, a sort of the ways in which they are sort of improvising, how they sort of figure out their way in this kind of new economy. And that's certainly part of the background or the backdrop story here, you know, sort of the aftermath of 2008. So even as the economy sort of slowly, you know, churns towards recovery, this idea of employment as the way that we understood it 20, 30, or 40 years ago is still really difficult for a lot of young people to access and to maintain. And so part of this book is, right, is really about how they're creating alternative paths to work, alternative kinds of careers, because in some ways, right, these are the kinds of dispositions, the kinds of skills that are going to be increasingly required in the future.
I mean, it's interesting to me. I think some people look at millennials and say, oh, they're just doing that because they want to, and yeah, they don't want to have. But it's an interesting question of, are they doing it because they want to or because they have to?
Yeah, no, it is. And that's something that I try to grapple with in the book. I think in some ways it's both and. So in some ways, one of my favorite quotes from the book, right, is from a young millennial. She makes podcasts, and she says, you know, talking about herself and members of her generation. She said, we work in jobs where nobody respects us, where we aren't treated very well. And so we find each other, we work together, and we do our side hustle, right? And so in some ways, right, I see this new innovation economy is not necessarily about, you know, pursuing wealth and celebrity, but really about pursuing dignity and opportunity.
That struck me too, that phrase dignity and opportunity. Maybe it's because I'm a little bit older, but that also makes me think about, is this something particular to being the age of a millennial? So as they're finding their way in the work world, will these same side hustles and innovation be as appealing when they need benefits, you know, and they need health insurance for a family? You know, I guess the bigger question here is this sustainable for the millennials who are kind of forging these paths and really changing and shifting the workplace?
Yeah. I think the short answer is no, it's not sustainable. And I think many of them recognize that, right? So, you know, we were talking to, you know, during our interviews with a variety of people, something that would come up is that, you know, this is the moment where they can take risk, right? This is the moment where they can pursue a side hustle. This is the moment where they can pursue an entrepreneurial enterprise. We know, for example, that millennials are delaying marriage, they're delaying starting families, they're delaying, you know, purchasing a home. So even though those have been sort of the standard or traditional markers in terms of, you know, transition into young adulthood, they're delaying those things, which gives them, right, a little bit more opportunity and freedom to pursue these more creative enterprises.
What's going to happen when they decide, though, that they're ready to do that?
Right. The hope is that the side hustle leads to, like, the main hustle, right? That becomes ultimately the main gig, the thing that you can turn to sustain yourself and sort of to create this standard of stability that you're referring to. The challenge, right, is that the reality is that in most cases, the side hustle doesn't turn into the main hustle, the main gig. It continues to be a side hustle. It continues to be something that's more aspirational than real. And I think that's something that many of them have to confront, right, as they get older, as they begin to sort of seek wanting to you know, settle down, have a family. I think these are sort of the issues that this generation is facing. We're hearing a lot, right, about the need for a basic income for everyone, for, you know, just maintaining a certain basic standard of living for people who are sort of grappling in this age of sort of uncertainty in what sociologists and economists refer to as the age of precarity.
Talk a little bit about access into the new innovation economy, because one of the hallmarks seems to be that access is broad and wide and deep in a way that young people haven't really been able to access any kind of employment opportunities, you know, directly out of school, whether it's high school or college before.
Right. Yeah. So there are many sort of elements that help to sort of open up access to this new economy, this new innovation economy. And one, obviously, is technology. Over the years, you know, as I've researched on people and their relationship to technology, you know, again, we hear over and over and over again about the woes and about the negative impacts of technology. But I think we oftentimes make the mistake that, you know, how a teenager uses technology today is a predictor of how she'll use that technology tomorrow. And my research suggests, right, that that's just simply not true. So as they get older, right, and as they begin to pursue these side hustles and trying to create a new career pathway, they see technology, right, as a resource to learn, as a resource to connect to other people, as a resource to sort of build this sort of community that allows them to sort of, access either the emotional resources that they need, the material resources that they need, and in some cases, if it's a Kickstarter fundraising campaign, the financial resources that they need.
So is it too broad to say that the technology is a great equalizer? So in other words, that young people of color or young people who are not coming from families of means may have entrees into worlds that previously were not as easily accessible?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. Inventive uses of the technology certainly do open up doors that otherwise may not have been open. In the book, for example, I talk about the rise of SoundCloud rappers, how they use that platform in a really creative way to literally create, right, what has become, you know, one of the sort of markers of kind of pop music today in terms of, you know, hip-hop's dominance in the streaming ecosystem, but how a lot of that began, right, with upstart sort of on-the-margin hip-hop artists really leveraging a platform like SoundCloud as a way to establish their voice, their brand, the community around their music. And so in that sense, that certainly was a tool that was used creatively to sort of amplify, you know, a genre or style of music that otherwise would have never been recognized by the commercial industry.
In the new innovation economy, what signals success? So, you know, in a traditional job in a corporation, you know, you get a promotion or a raise or your widget sells a lot or whatever. But in a less sort of tangible environment, something like SoundCloud, where people are accessing your file or you know how many listens or likes you have, is it harder to sort of come up with metrics for success in this economy?
It is. And I think this is something that's sort of ongoing and evolving too. So in other words, how young creatives define success in a new innovation economy, you know, the metrics might be very different than how we have traditionally defined success, right? So success may be, you know, maybe measuring, impact, for example. So I talk in the book, right, about young creatives who are sort of using tech in a way to sort of launch what I call civic startups, right? And so in that case, success might be how many people you're able to mobilize online, how many people you're able then to sort of help to, create new sort of social movements in their local communities. So in that sense, you know, bringing in more diverse people in the tech space and in the sort of civic entrepreneurial space. And so in that sense, success, is marked very differently, right, by the diversity of people that you're able to touch, the diversity of people that you're able to include, and how that then allows you to perhaps spread influence in some unique and distinct ways.
Are the infrastructures and institutions of the traditional economy ready to support the new innovation economy? And I'm thinking of things like our public school system. Are they agile enough to sort of adapt to this, or are they waiting to see what happens? Yeah. What is that landscape?
Yeah, no, that's something that I thought a lot about this book. And, toward the end, as I began to sort of think about these issues in a much more direct way, I would say that the answer to that question is no. And part of why I wrote this book, right, was a way to sort of communicate to stakeholders to policymakers, to educators, to employers, that these are the kinds of skills that young people are developing. These are the kinds of skills that are going to be increasingly required in the future economy: inventiveness, innovation, flexibility, the ability to, engage in what we call lifelong learning, sort of creating these, innovation ecosystems that allow you to access resources that you otherwise might not have access to. And those are skills that are obviously very different than the ones customarily emphasized by our schools, for example. And so there are a couple of chapters in the book about what I call young creatives who are trying to disrupt the education space, right? And how do we begin to think about, what kinds of skills are increasingly in high demand in an innovation economy, right? And I talk a lot about design, right? And what I like about the design sort of perspective is that designers, when they look out into the world, they don't see the world as it is, but as it could be, right? And how can I fix a problem, or how can I create something that offers a credible or compelling solution? And so this idea of a design disposition, in the book I talk about, young entrepreneurs in the education space who are trying to help youth of color, but young people in general, develop those kinds of skills, to cultivate that kind of a disposition that really positions them to be much more effective in this future sort of moving forward.
What does society have to do in order to have a situation where the disruptors are not the disruptors anymore, but they're the thought leaders? Does that question make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, what does it take to sort of shift society so that they are ready to kind of have institutions catch up with what's already happening?
Absolutely. I think part of it, right, is, so much of what I learned about this book is that, the way in which young creatives see the world is based on many of the things that we've talked about here, right? How they experience that world economically, how they experience that world politically, educationally. And so they just offer, right, a really unique perspective. They bring a really interesting set of ideas to the table. And I think, if it's public schools, if it's, local, city councils and other stakeholders, if we could figure out ways, right, to incorporate that perspective and incorporate those voices and expertise into our solution making, industries or machines, then we might actually end up generating ideas and generating solutions that are much more relevant. So in other words, right, that means being much more diverse and inclusive in terms of leadership, in terms of management, in terms of stakeholders. And so in that sense, I think sort of respecting them and understanding that they bring a perspective and ideas and expertise that can be meaningful and valuable and really help us to sort of think about how do we build, a future economy, if it's in education, if it's in civic life, if it's in economic life, how do we build that in a way that's in partnership with them and that sort of leans on their experience and their sort of expertise, but also their energy and creativity to help us sort of remake a world that's fairer, more equitable, and more accessible.
Did the millennials that you interviewed and spoke with for the book, do they hope to keep their side hustles and gigs going for their whole career? Or do they anticipate that someday they will have to transition into something more traditional? Because what I'm wondering is, if the innovation economy and gig work is so appealing, where then do the teachers come from? And where do the auto mechanics come from? And where do doctors come from when working, a flexible, non-traditional schedule is way more appealing?
Yeah. I suspect that if they had access to jobs that were stable, jobs that offered a certain degree of security, but also dignity as well, I suspect that they would certainly prefer those jobs. But the thing about the side hustle, right, is, again, it's increasingly not necessarily just about wealth or making money, but it really is about, finding opportunity to express your creative self, or to create something that you think the world could benefit from. And that's civic, that's entrepreneurial in a way that isn't necessarily about economic generation, but about, social good or civic impact. And it'll be interesting to see how this generation evolves, right? And to what extent they continue engaging in those kinds of behaviors, even when, right, they have to maintain different kinds of jobs in order to maintain, a stable household.
Tell us a little bit about how you did the research and interviews for this book.
Yeah, so this research was part of funding from the MacArthur Foundation. It was part of a research network that I was grateful enough to be a part of. And my team was interested primarily in what we might call the future of work and how young people navigate that future of work. So I had a team of graduate students here at the University of Texas, students from sociology, students from communication, students from policy. And we got together, sort of strategized how we would design a study. But we just went out in Austin, right, and meeting different communities in the music and creative community, hip-hop artists. I mentioned earlier, right, independent game developers. We also met with a lot of independent designers and entrepreneurs, people in civic tech, for example, and just started observing them, right, in hackathons and meetups and all of these really inventive ways in which they get together to collaborate and share ideas, meeting with them, doing interviews with them, observing them in different kinds of spaces, in their apartments, you know, in communities. Innovation lab spaces and co-working spaces, and just collected all of that data and began to start trying to see what themes and what stories emerged that we think help to give us a better insight into this world that they're in, both inhabiting but also creating as well.
How would you describe sort of their outlook, I guess? Are they happy to be in on the kind of front lines of sort of these big shifts? You described sort of, you know, taking risks, it's the time of life to take risks. Are they happy with that? Are they nervous? How would you sort of characterize their feelings and approach to all of
this? Yeah, I would say that largely because they don't have much of a choice, that they've sort of embraced the challenges that are before them. But they also, I think, are trying to figure out where there are opportunities within this moment as well. I mean, most surveys, you know, tend to suggest that that millennials tend to be optimistic about their future. They tend to be optimistic about their economic prospects. And again, I think they're redefining, right, what success looks like. They're redefining, you know, what opportunity looks like. And so for them, success may not look like it did for a generation or two ago, right? The white picket fence, you know, two-car garage, you know, the two or three children in the household. For them, right, you know, the reality is likely to be something very different. And I think they're okay with that, largely in part because they really don't have much of a choice, right? This is the world that they've inhabited or inherited. And now I think they are in many ways poised to think about how can we make this world better, safer, more equitable for our kids and for future generations.
Did you make any specific plans as part of your research? Are you curious to kind of do a similar look like 5 or 10 years down the road? I mean, are you curious about sort of how to find out how all of this goes?
I am, yeah. So it's interesting now, right? Because the oldest millennials are about 38 now. The youngest are about 22 or 23 years of age. And so again, right, they now make up the largest segment of our workforce. They are becoming, you know, parents and are beginning to raise families. And so it'll be interesting to see, right, how their experience through all of this sort of shapes how they think about family, how they think about community, how they think about civic life. We're seeing really interesting demonstrations and expressions from them about, you know, our fractured sort of political landscape right now, and how they hope to perhaps repair that in a way that's much more sustainable and certainly what many people would believe much more ethical as well.
It's interesting because sort of if you think about it, they've come of kind of personal and professional age in a time when on the one hand, they can really make their voices heard and participate through all this technology and media. But on the other hand, you know, you're talking about divisiveness. It also puts them in a place of always seeing these fights and backs and forths. And it's a very different kind of environment to develop in.
And I think you're exactly right. And because they've been on the front lines of this change in a way that's been both exciting and in some ways, you know, troubling, sort of problematic as well. I think they, too, are at the vanguard of what we call or what's increasingly being called the sort of digital wellness movement. And we saw evidence of this, and I talk about it a bit in the book, in terms of how they're seeking out ways to think about their own sort of personal, physical, and mental health, right? And how do you slow down and how do you begin to sort of navigate the sort of information environment where information is coming at you nonstop, flurry, flurry, flurry. And we're learning now, you know, more and more of it sort of purposely sort of disinformation designed in some ways to polarize, designed in some ways to misinform. And I think, you know, as they have experienced this, right, in some fairly dramatic and profound ways, they are also beginning to think about solutions, right, and how do we begin to protect ourselves and how do we begin to promote wellness in an environment, right, that can sometimes be, not necessarily for our own benefit.
You know, it occurs to me, I should ask, because we've been talking a lot about kind of the positives of this and their optimism, the millennials. What did you all come across as the biggest downsides of the new innovation economy? You mentioned lack of stability. What are some of the other downsides?
Yeah. Well, definitely, right? I talk, you know, about the side hustle, but I also talk about the side effects of the side hustle, right? And what I mean by that, right, is that there is both a mental and physical toll for the side hustle lifestyle. Because by definition, side hustle means, right, expending energy that you may or may not have, both mental and physical energy. And many young people talked about the physical and mental toll that takes. And so they're very much aware that that this sort of new innovation economy. There are certain costs that come with it, which is why I think they're increasingly mobilizing to try to figure out ways to provide safeguards, right, for mental health, provide safeguards for their physical health, sort of recognizing, right, that oftentimes that side hustle lifestyle, while you're young, you know, may be something that you can pursue, but it's certainly not a lifestyle that you want to pursue, right, for the remainder of one's life.
Craig Watkins is author of Don't Knock the Hustle, Young Creatives, Tech Ingenuity, and the Making of the New Innovation Economy. He's founding director of the Institute for Media Innovation at the Moody College of Communication at UT Austin. Craig, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.